America's manipulative neoconservatives who support unending aggression against any country that does not succumb to United States political, economic, and military control are taking a page from Nazi Germany's leaders in their quest for world domination.
You cannot achieve a major amelioration of hate crimes and discrimination and civil liberties problems facing Arab Americans and Arabs in the United States without affecting some sort of change in the American role in the Middle East.
There's this enormous power structure that goes hugely beyond any one man or even the administration, and that's really to be considered the enemy.
If you look at the U.S. occupation and its achievements in building civil society so far, the chances of it getting any food distribution program up in the next 4 months is pretty minimal.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, May 20th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration raised the national terror alert level to orange today amid fears a wave of terrorist attacks overseas will spread to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security officials initially provided few specific reasons for the alert, which will set in motion a series of security measures around the federal government. It also advises cities, states, and businesses to take extra security measures. Chief Spokesman Ari Fleischer said President Bush's Homeland Security Council decided to raise the terror alert warning during a meeting at the White House. After their session, Bush informed of the council's decision, which is binding and takes immediate effect, by Chief of Staff Andrew Card. The alert was raised after top administration and counterterrorism officials reviewed intelligence reports suggesting domestic terrorist attacks were possible. The new level orange marks a high threat of terrorist attacks. It's the second highest level on the five-color scale. The previous level, yellow, marked an elevated risk. Counterterrorism officials had previously described the bulk of the terrorism intelligence as pointing towards attacks overseas. Officials believe Al-Qaeda has launched a series of strikes loosely coordinated by the organization's top leadership aimed at demonstrating Al-Qaeda is still viable. They believe attacks in Morocco and Saudi are part of this. The United Nations held closed-door sessions today to discuss a proposed U.S. resolution to lift the economic sanctions on Iraq and to phase out the humanitarian oil for food program over the next 6 months. The draft also authorizes the U.S. and the U.K. as occupying powers in Iraq to use future oil revenues to rebuild the country. And the U.S. and Britain would be able to determine how much oil Iraq will sell, how it will be priced, and which companies will buy it. But the proposed resolution has raised concerns among France, Russia, and a number of other countries on the Security Council who have questioned what they perceive as an insufficient U.N. role in the process. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent for The Nation magazine. We asked him about some of those concerns.
The fact that this resolution is here at all is the result of George W. Bush's stunned surprise that international law means something. Even American oil companies operate in a global market, and they discovered, the U.S. administration discovered, that none of these oil companies would buy oil without a clear title, because otherwise they were liable for lawsuits from anyone anywhere in the world. And that's their eagerness, is that they want a carte blanche, they want a get-out-of-jail-free card for the oil revenues. Otherwise it can't be traded on the international markets, and that deeply concerns the U.S., because they want the revenues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in everybody's mind. The U.S. was, U.S. companies were the end users of most of, I think by the end of the Oil for Food program, they were buying up most of it to stock up the strategic reserve ready for the war. Yeah, irony is bigger in the rich part of the world.
The vote is coming amidst fierce opposition from Russia, which is demanding that U.N. weapons inspectors first certify that Iraq is free of weapons of mass destruction. Can you explain Moscow's position on that?
I think it's not just Moscow's position. It's what's fierce about the Russians is that they're expressing what everybody else is saying. I think even the British, if they had their druthers, would rather have the weapons inspectors in, and shortly. Everyone would be agreeable to suspending the sanctions. It's the final ending of them. And the real issue here is not so much Iraq as setting really dangerous precedents under international law for the future. And that's why, you know, people have realized that the U.S. doesn't actually listen very much to people. It just gets annoyed. So I think they're mostly speaking softly, but trying to use big sticks behind the scenes to get a little leverage out of the resolution.
You think that Moscow and perhaps others are concerned that this is a slippery slope that they don't want to go down, even though it's specifically geared at Iraq in this instance? It could be expanded to others in the future.
Oh, that's precisely what they're worried about. This modified, toned-down version gives the Iraqi sort of, gives the authority power over Iraqi oil until 2007, which means that this is the only nearest thing to a timeline in the resolution. It means they're looking at a four-year-plus occupation. And there's the whole issues of who would authorize this new government if ever it came in. They've beefed up the role of the UN, at least by title. He's no longer a special coordinator. He's now a special representative. But his main job is fairly clearly to coordinate. Apart from, I think they've added intensively to the phrase there about what his efforts to rebuild Iraqi society. But it's clear that all the way through, the whip hand in the end is to come back to the authority, which is nominally, of course, American and British, but is going to be American from what we've seen so far. Also, the fund which they're setting up to sort of stash the oil money away in, they want all of the privileges that the United Nations traditionally has against litigation to be given to an organization which is basically the conqueror's slush fund.
Mm-hmm. And it seems a bit ironic that the U.S. is minimizing the importance of the U.N. weapons inspector's process after previously threatening to attack Iraq if the inspectors were not permitted access.
We seem to have forgotten the official excuse internationally was going after the weapons and to enforce cooperation with the weapons inspectors. But the rest of the world hasn't forgotten this and wants to keep coming back to it. All of the existing resolutions on Iraq say very firmly that sanctions will be lifted after the weapons inspectors have certified that it's free from weapons of mass destruction. And what they've attempted to do with the revised version here, the first version just ignored the weapons inspectors. Now they sort of hinted that eventual verification will come, but this will come after the sanctions are lifted, after the international community has given up any leverage they have over the occupation. Then maybe at some point down the line, the U.S. and the British will allow UNMEVEC in, or maybe even just ask them to look at the evidence produced by the United States and certify it. There's no sort of particular leverage or compulsion this gives for the rest of the world on the U.S. occupation.
Why do you suppose the U.S. has made such a quick rush to call for the lifting of the sanctions? What's your take on that?
The big issue is there's a deadline coming up, which is June the 3rd, which is when the present sort of extension of the oil for food program goes, and this means they will not be able to sell them. And already it's causing problems because the oil is sort of coagulating in the pipes. There's nowhere to store it. There's no movement. The oil industry needs long-term contracts to sort of lift the stuff and take it away. So there really is a sort of compelling, you know, physical and chemical deadline as well as a legal one. So they need something by June the 3rd, the sooner the better, to turn around. I don't think they're going to get a resolution. I'd be very surprised if they got a resolution tomorrow. I think there's far too many objections. But on the other hand, what they do have on their side is a lot of people are sort of still quite grateful that the U.S. actually came back to the Security Council at all. Hmm. They know there's some people in the administration who'd rather that they didn't. In a way, it's as though the lynch mob came back to the court and asked for the court's blessing on what they did afterwards.
Hmm. Hmm.
You know, at least it shows some deference to the law, even if you broke it beforehand.
In addition to lifting the sanctions, this draft issued by U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. John Negroponte also calls for a phasing out over the next 6 months of the Oil for Food humanitarian program.
Mm-hmm. But that's an extension from 4 months, which was what the first resolution had.
Mm-hmm. Which is currently the main source of food for two-thirds of Iraqis. What effects will this have, and what will come of Iraq's civil structure in the absence of the program?
Well, all of these things are sort of have strange unintended consequences. I think this is not so much the 4 month to 6 month extension isn't so much a recognition of pressure from other countries as a sort of quick reality check. If you look at the U.S. occupation and its achievements in building civil society so far, the chances of it getting any food distribution program up in the next 4 months is pretty minimal. So they need the Oil for Food program to get up and running. It wouldn't surprise me if they didn't even come back and ask for an extension at the end of 6 months. But they also want this money to be funneled very quickly into the Iraqi Development Fund so that they can use it to pay for civil servants and to sort of head off civil unrest beyond that. Otherwise, the U.S. taxpayer will have to pay. And we know that the U.S. taxpayers don't like paying taxes, least of all for foreigners.
Hmm. I've heard that France says that the resolution gives a, quote, insufficient role to the U.N. in Iraq's rebuilding process.
I think that's the French being tactful and euphemistic. It gives zilch role to the U.N. in the rebuilding process, except the special representative, who was before the special coordinator, he's got sort of vague responsibilities but no powers. And on previous experience, I would say that his main role for the U.S. in about 6 months' time will be to carry the can for the total failure to rebuild Iraqi society and business and industry.
Mm. And where is Iraq in all of this? Dare I ask if the people of Iraq will have any say in determining the future of their own country?
Well, at the moment, if you saw, they're all busy demonstrating outside U.S. occupation places, saying, first of all, they'd rather not have the Americans in. And even the Iraqi National Council is sort of echoing some of the calls from the United Nations to say that they want power sooner. You know, even the carpetbaggers want to get their hands on the oil revenues faster than the without leaving them in the U.S. hands. So there's no, they can't really produce a big domestic constituency in Iraq, and I think there's some very serious concern. Because the longer that they postpone setting up a genuine indigenous and authoritative Iraqi central government, you are going to have more and more tendency to sort of regionalism and warlordism, with the Shia areas and the Kurds and others sort of setting up their own little feudal enclaves. We're going to have the Afghanistanization of Iraq. And then I think you can see that apart from looking after the oil terminals, the U.S. will probably wash its hands of civil society. It's what they did in Afghanistan.
Mm. We've heard Ian Williams that closed-door discussion on this resolution is taking place at the U.N. all day today. How much support does it currently have, and what's expected to come of it?
Well, I think some people, even the opposition, are sort of pleasantly surprised that the U.S. has proved slightly more amenable. You know, there were fears to begin with that it would be a sort of straight take it or leave it. So even though there's only a quibbling on the details so far, there have been, the U.S. is trying hard to bribe and win over other parties on the Security Council. It's not going to concede on the main issues, but it's already made some small concessions to legality. It remains to be seen just how many of them will come out in over the next week or so. As I said, I think that Wednesday is hopeless. But nobody wants to annoy the Americans at the moment. Nobody wants to get up. I think that's the difference, is that these discussions are closed-door ones. You don't have the French foreign minister, you know, hurling insults at the Americans and vice versa in public. You have sort of discreet, low-level discussions. Nobody wants to be accused of helping to keep the Iraqis starving and keeping Iraqi sanctions on. But nobody wants to get up and be seen legalizing an illegal U.S. occupation. So they're being very discreet in how they're handling it. I think the negotiations will be much tougher than the Americans expect.
Ian Williams, U.N. correspondent for The Nation magazine. With talks of sanctions being lifted, focus is now turning to U.S. policymakers. Wayne Mattson, Washington correspondent for Intelligence Online and author of America's Nightmare, The Presidency of George Bush II, offers an unflinching critique of the neoconservatives in this commentary.
America's manipulative neoconservatives, who support unending aggression against any country that does not succumb to United States political, economic, and military control, and who themselves seize power in Washington through electoral malfeasance, are taking a page from Nazi Germany's leaders in their quest for world domination. It is no coincidence that the neocons are worried about comparisons between their policies and those of Hitler. Ed Gernon, the Canadian executive producer of the CBS miniseries, Hitler, The Rise of Evil, was fired when he suggested similarities between the methods used by both Hitler and Bush to wipe away civil liberties by playing on popular fear. The Nazi-like campaign against Gernon was launched by the New York Post and TV Guide, both owned by proto-fascist Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. Many of the neocons adhere to the political philosophy of Leo Strauss, a German Jew who fled Nazi Germany for the United States in 1933. Strauss began teaching at the University of Chicago. To his supporters, Strauss was a modern-day Plato or Machiavelli. However, to his detractors, Strauss was something far more sinister, a disciple of German philosophers Friedrich Nietzsche and Martin Heidegger, two of the philosophical pillars of National Socialism. In fact, Heidegger eventually joined the Nazi Party and became one of its most ardent defenders. After being caught lying about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to prove their flimsy case that Iraq was a world-class threat, the neocons now are planting fabricated documents in the rubble of Iraqi intelligence and secret police facilities. Through a media laundering process, discovered documents are handed over to right-wing outlets owned by such slash-and-burn media moguls as Murdoch, Conrad Black, and Sung Myung Moon. We are now being fed information that captured Iraqi intelligence documents prove that France assisted escaping members of Saddam Hussein's government by handing them French passports in Syria. This follows repeated allegations that other documents proved French and Russian and German intelligence cooperation with Iraq's intelligence service before the war. Syria has been accused of accepting Iraq's phony weapons of mass destruction. Iran is accused of helping al-Qaeda, its most bitter enemy. Hitler used false evidence and phony rhetoric to justify his invasions of Danzig, Austria, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. American ambassadors in New Zealand, Norway, Turkey, Greece, Canada, Mexico, Barbados, Jamaica, Brazil, Chile, and Luxembourg have acted like Nazi German Foreign Minister Joachim von Ribbentrop's bellicose ambassadors in bullying nations that failed to support the U.S. war on Iraq. France is being faced with being kicked out of NATO military planning meetings, Germany with the loss of U.S. military bases, Belgium with the loss of NATO's headquarters, and Canada, Chile, and Mexico with trade sanctions. There are lies, damned lies, in Ahmad Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi National Congress, stooge of the neocons, and a convicted bank embezzler, is now aiming his wrath at Jordan. Chalabi, who bilked the American taxpayers out of millions of dollars from State Department and CIA budgets in order to fight his self-styled struggle against Saddam from the restaurants of London's Mayfair district and the clothiers of Savile Row, now claims that recently found documents implicate Jordan's royal family in Saddam's spider's web. Of course, it was a Jordanian court that found Chalabi guilty of stealing $300 million from the country's Petra Bank, and which sentenced him to over 20 years at hard labor. It is surprising that it took this golem-like sycophantic creature so long to accuse the Jordanians of being in bed with Saddam. Of course, Chalabi will not admit that while he was a math professor at the American University of Beirut during the 1970s, he served as a virtual agent for the Shah of Iran's feared Savak secret police. So much for Chalabi's democratic credentials, and so much for explaining his support for using Iraq as a base for the United States to attack Iran and install the son of the Shah upon a resurrected peacock throne. Chalabi fits in well with other congenital liars who now lead the United States government. Chief among them are those who prevaricated at every turn about why the United States went to war against Iraq. Why does the Bush administration lie so much? It is mainly because Bush's Svengali-like political advisor, Karl Rove, has taken to heart the advice of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels and the neocon philosopher Leo Strauss. If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. That's what Joseph Goebbels said. Rove has lived by this tenet throughout his political career. During the 2000 GOP primary campaign, it was the hand of Rove that was behind the vicious rumors about Senator John McCain's prisoner of war record, his adopted daughter, his marital fidelity, and even his sexual orientation. Rove's guns were then turned on Vice President Al Gore in the general election with similar lies about the vice president's Vietnam service and Senate voting record. A true symbiotic relationship exists between Rove and the neocons. Rove provides them a nurturing host, the Pentagon, in which to operate, procreate politically, and periodically ejaculate disinformation. No sooner had the fake Iraqi intelligence documents exposing links between Saddam on one hand and Germany, France, and British Labour Party, a member of Parliament George Galloway on the other, been revealed, other documents fingering former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, Washington Democratic Representative Jim McDermott, former House Democratic Whip David Bonnier, Michigan's anti-war representative John Conyers, Michigan Democratic Senator Carl Levin, and the 1996 Clinton-Gore campaign is similarly being linked to Saddam. It is fitting and timely that the Senate recently disclosed files from the hearings of the disgraced Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy. He also emulated Goebbels in using the big lie tactic. Rove and the neocons relish in the big lie. It is their lifeblood. Without it, they would be impotent. The neocons' obsessive use of the lie means that whatever they state, the opposite is true. They are the liars. Those who call them on their lies are the truth-sayers. Lying and character assassination have paid off handsomely for the neocons. Another Nazi leader provided neocons with a blueprint for the strategy seen in the repeated attacks on those who dare question the party line. Their targets range from the Dixie Chicks, Senator Robert Byrd, Bill Maher, and Michael Moore, to Tim Robbins and Susan Sarandon, to ABC News anchor Peter Jennings and MSNBC reporter Ashley Banfield. Nazi Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, before committing suicide at the Nuremberg trials, appeared to be advising the future neocons. Quote, voice or no voice, the people can always be brought to the bidding of the leaders. That is easy. All you have to do is tell them they are being attacked and denounce the peacemakers for lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same in any country. A little advice for the neocons and your nurturers. Every day you're creating more and more enemies within the United States and abroad. They are beginning to understand intermeshing dependencies and are connecting the dots. The dots are Enron, Hollinger, Unocal, Halliburton, Carlyle Group, Trirem, L3, SAIC, etc. Your aggressive policies are upsetting the global balance of power, destroying economies, threatening international trade, and first and foremost, killing innocent people. Like the Nazis in Nuremberg, you will one day face an accounting for your crimes. As with the Nazis who stood in the dock in Nuremberg, few, if anyone, will be in the mood to grant you clemency or mercy.
Wayne Madsen, Washington correspondent for Intelligence Online, based in Paris, France. He's also the author of America's Nightmare, The Presidency of George Bush II. As the 2004 election season approaches, the nation's largest Arab American membership organization is placing more emphasis on shaping civil liberties and U.S. foreign policy through elected officials. Communications Director for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, Hussein Ibish, spoke this weekend about his organization's widening of focus in order to wield more power in the U.S. political arena. We bring you part of his address recorded Sunday in Houston, where he spoke on issues of civil liberties and U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East.
Progress must be made on both issues simultaneously, that you cannot achieve a major amelioration of hate crimes and discrimination and civil liberties problems facing Arab Americans and Arabs in the United States without affecting some sort of change in the American role in the Middle East. I think that's clear to all of us. And what we're looking at right now is a situation in which there is a major faction in the government. I'm talking here about the neoconservatives in the Vice President's office and in the Department of Defense, who have an open agenda that is extremely aggressive against large parts of the Arab world and some of the Muslim world beyond, that is extremely pro-Israel, that does not see any distinction between American interests and Israeli interests as defined by General Sharon, and that has had the momentum in our government and foreign policy making for a couple of years now. At the moment, it would appear that some major amount of momentum has shifted back to the State Department, where foreign policy is supposed to be made, where we still face major problems, but not as severe as we face with the neoconservatives. The point is, there is a huge fight going on in the administration, and neither position is really compatible with our views or our interests, etc. And we are bystanders. You know, our attempts to intervene, our attempts to give weight to one side or another, frankly, have not borne fruit and are not likely to. And that I want to kind of put that on the table as well, because it is a major problem that we face. So we are even more ineffective when it comes to foreign policy, where we advocate, we lobby, we argue, we write, we do this, we do that, and we really haven't gotten anywhere. We really are not a force in the American foreign policy debate, because that is the debate, frankly, where there is most at stake, right? And where you need real influence, real political capital, real clout before you can enter effectively into that debate. The stakes are high. We have, as a community, subjected ourselves to an incredibly ill-advised situation of voluntary disenfranchisement from the American political system, because we are not organized. We are not organized. I say that with all due respect for the people in this room who've done such great work here. To some extent, I'm preaching to the choir. The fact that you're sitting here listening to me means that you know already that what I'm saying is true, but I'm going to say it anyway. If you took, the situation is so bad that if you took everyone who is a member of an Arab American organization, either national or local, plus, and in addition to that, added all the Arab Americans who identify primarily as Muslims and have joined some Muslim group, and took them and added it in as people who are organized in some way or another, you're still talking, the overall pool would still be a tiny percentage of our community. Certainly less than 5%. I say that with absolute confidence. I mean, I cannot give you a precise figure, but I have no doubt whatsoever that that is the case. That is a generous estimate. And there has never been a serious and sustained Arab-American attempt to engage in politics at the highest level in this country, which, for a community of a couple few million people, cannot be about voter mobilization, because we will not sway elections anywhere outside of Dearborn. The way you engage is through the campaign finance system. That's how you get politicians' attention. That is the one and only way. It is the be-all and end-all. It is the American political system. People sit there, 400 members of the House, some 100 members of the Senate, and a president who sits atop a political party who not only has to think about his future, but the future of all his subordinates in the Congress, and then more local levels of politics. All of these people have a primary task, which is to be reelected. They are there. In the case of the House, they have to get reelected every 2 years. Right? I mean, it's the number one thing on their agenda. In almost all cases, is to get reelected. And in the United States, the key to that is money. I mean, almost every case, the candidate that spends more money will win the election. It is very unusual that that is not the case. And certainly, you cannot hope to get elected without getting financial support. That is absolutely critical. And there is not. We have one Arab American in the Senate, right, John Sununu, and 8 or 9 in the House, right, plus 2 in the cabinet, but that doesn't really count, but 8 or 9 in the House. Not one of them, not one single one of them was put there by us. Not one single one of them can thank the Arab American community or their local Arab American community as being an important factor in getting them in the Senate or the House. They are not there because of us. They are there in spite of us. They are there in spite of us. Their affiliation with our community is actually something they had to overcome. Yeah, I'm an Arab American, but, you know, or just avoid the subject altogether, or something like that. This is not because they are bad people, or because they are ashamed of their ethnicity. Most of them are not. They're quite proud of it. The thing is that we have not provided our friends political cover. We have not provided our kinfolk in American politics political cover by providing them with the financial support that they need to operate properly. People get very upset with Daryl Issa, a Republican freshman from Orange County, California, who has done some very good things and who has voted in some ways that had really not been consistent also with the views of our community. And people are really mad at him and say, well, why doesn't he do that? Doesn't he know he's an Arab? Doesn't he? Yeah, but he also knows that he's a freshman Republican in a swing state and that his chances of getting reelected depend on the support of the RNC and the support of the president. And he has no chance of winning without that support. And so what we are basically asking someone like that to do is to, in effect, sacrifice their political career or risk everything they worked for to get to that situation in order to please us when we have not done anything to help them. This is unreasonable. It is even more unreasonable when you look at other members of Congress. Right? We haven't got a voice on Capitol Hill.
Hussein Ibish, National Communications Director for the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, speaking in Houston this weekend with the local chapter of the ADC. His address was recorded by KPFT's J.P. Caldwell and produced by Renee Feltz. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.